It is similar, in a way, with Clive. His semantic memory, while of little help in organizing his life, does have a crucial social role. It allows him to engage in conversation, though it is occasionally more monologue than conversation. Thus, Deborah wrote, he would string all his subjects together in a row, and the other person simply needed to nod or mumble. By moving rapidly from one thought to another, Clive managed to secure a sort of continuity, to hold the thread of consciousness and attention intact, albeit precariously, for the thoughts were held together on the whole by superficial associations. Clive's verbosity made him a little odd, a little too much at times, but it was highly adaptive. It enabled him to re-enter the world of human discourse. In the 1986 BBC film, Deborah quoted Proust's description of Swann waking in a strange room, not knowing at first where he was, who he was, what he was. He had only the most rudimentary sense of existence, such as may lurk and flicker in the depths of an animal's consciousness, until memory came back to him, like a rope let down from heaven to draw me up out of the abyss of not being, from which I could never have escaped by myself. This gave him back his personal consciousness and identity. No rope from heaven, no autobiographical memory will ever come down in this way to Clive. From the start, there have been, for Clive, two realities of immense importance. The first of these is Deborah, whose presence and love for him have made life tolerable, at least intermittently, in the 20 or more years since his illness. Clive's amnesia not only destroyed his ability to retain new memories, it deleted almost all of his earlier memories, including those of the years when he met and fell in love with Deborah. He told Deborah, when she questioned him, that he had never heard of John Lennon or John F. Kennedy. Though he always recognized his own children, Deborah told me, he would be surprised at their height and amazed to hear he is a grandfather. He asked his younger son what O-level exams he was doing in 2005, more than 20 years after Edmund left school. Yet somehow he always recognized Deborah as his wife when she visited and felt moored by her presence, lost without her. He would rush to the door when he heard her voice and embrace her with passionate, desperate fervor. Having no idea how long she had been away, since anything not in his immediate field of perception and attention would be lost, forgotten, within seconds, he seemed to feel that she, too, had been lost in the abyss of time, and so her return from the abyss seemed nothing short of miraculous. Clive was constantly surrounded by strangers in a strange place, Deborah wrote, with no knowledge of where he was or what had happened to him. To catch sight of me was always a massive relief, to know that he was not alone, that I still cared, that I loved him, that I was there. Clive was terrified all the time, but I was his life, I was his lifeline. Every time he saw me, he would run to me, fall on me, sobbing, clinging. How, why, when he recognized no one else with any consistency, did Clive recognize Deborah? There are clearly many sorts of memory, and emotional memory is one of the deepest and least understood. Neil J. Cohen has written about the famous experiment of Edouard Claparède, a Swiss physician, in 1911. Upon shaking hands with a patient with Korsakoff syndrome, the condition which caused my patient Jimmy's severe amnesia, Claparède pricked her finger with a pin hidden in his hand. Subsequently, whenever he again attempted to shake the patient's hand, she promptly withdrew it. When he questioned her about this behavior, she replied, "Isn't it allowed to withdraw one's hand? And perhaps there is a pin hidden in your hand." And finally, "Sometimes pins are hidden in hands." Thus the patient learned the appropriate response based on previous experience, but she never seemed to attribute her behavior to the personal memory of some previously experienced event. For Claparède's patient, some sort of memory of the pain, an implicit and emotional memory, persisted. It seems certain, likewise, that in the first 2 years of life, even though one retains no explicit memories, Freud called this infantile amnesia. Deep emotional memories or associations are nevertheless being made in the limbic system and other regions of the brain where emotions are represented. And these emotional memories may determine one's behavior for a lifetime. And a recent paper by Oliver Turnbull et al. Has shown that patients with amnesia can form emotional transferences to an analyst, even though they retain no explicit memory of the analyst or their previous meetings. Nevertheless, a strong emotional bond begins to develop. Clive and Deborah were newly married at the time of his encephalitis and deeply in love for a few years before that. His passionate relationship with Deborah, a relationship that began before his encephalitis and one that centers in part on their shared love for music, has engraved itself in him, in areas of his brain unaffected by the encephalitis, so deeply that his amnesia, the most severe amnesia ever recorded, cannot eradicate it.